as near as his hand, and as remote as a star. And for the moment it was enough to be where she was. He wrote again to set his father straight, but this letter arrived in Washington after the Henrys had left for Germany. Chapter 3. In all her years as a Navy wife, Rhoda had never become reconciled to packing and moving. She could do it well enough, compiling long lists, remembering tiny details, waking in the middle of the night to scrawl notes, but she became a termagant. The angry voice rang in the house from dawn to midnight. Pug spent the days in the Office of Naval Intelligence, boning up on Germany, and ate most of his meals at the Army and Navy Club. Still, on the short notice given her, Rhoda accomplished everything. Stored the furniture, closed the house and put it up for rent, paid the bills, packed her clothes and Pug's heavy double wardrobe of civilian dress and uniforms, and moved Madeline to the home of her sister. The gold letters B-R-E-M-E-N stretched across the curved black stern of the steamship, high over the cobbled waterfront street. Above the letters, an immense red flag rippled in the cool, fishy breeze off the Hudson, showing at its center a big black swastika circled in white. "Glory be, it all really exists," Madeline said to Warren as she got out of the taxicab. "What really exists?" Warren said. "Oh, this whole Hitler business. The Nazis, the Sieg Heils, the book burnings. When you read about it in the papers, it all seems too ridiculous and crazy to be real. But there's the swastika." Victor Henry glanced up at the Nazi flag, wrinkling his whole face. Rhoda was briskly giving the porter orders about the luggage. "I had to get special permission to ride this bucket. Let's hope the German language practice proves to be worth it. Come aboard with us and have a look at the ship." In a first-class stateroom paneled in gloomy carved wood, they sat making melancholy small talk amid piled suitcases and trunks, until Rhoda restlessly jumped up and took Warren with her for a walk around the Bremen. Madeline chose the moment to jolt her father with the news that she wanted to drop out of college. The prospect of living with her dull aunt and duller uncle and twin cousins for 2 years was unbearable, she said. "But what can you do? 2 years of college and you keep failing courses," Victor Henry said. "You can't just lie around and read Vogue till you get married."
"I'd find a job, Dad. I can work. I'm just bored at school. I hate studying. I always have. I'm not like you, or Warren. I'm more like Byron, I guess. I can't help it."
"I never liked studying," Commander Henry returned. "Nobody does. You do what you must and get it done." Perched on the edge of a deep armchair, the girl said with her most winning smile,
"Please, let me take just 1 year off. I'll prove I can do it. There are lots of jobs for girls at the radio networks in New York. If I don't make good, I'll promise I'll trot back to college and—"
"What? New York? 19 and alone in New York. Are you nuts?"
"Let me just try it this summer."
"No. You'll go with Aunt Augusta to Newport, the way it's been planned. You've always enjoyed Newport."
"For a week, yes. A whole summer will be a perishing bore."
"That's where you'll go. In the fall, I'll expect regular letters from you, reporting improved performance in college." Madeline, slumping back in the armchair, bit noisily into an apple from a heaping Bon Voyage basket of fresh fruit, sent by Kip Tolliver. Staring straight ahead, except for brief mutinous stares at her father, she gnawed at the apple until her mother and brother returned. Pug did his best to ignore the glares, reading a book on German steelmaking. He did not like parting from his daughter on such terms, but her proposal seemed to him unthinkable. The Bremen sailed at noon. As Warren and Madeline left the pier, a band thumped out a merry German waltz. They took a taxi uptown, saying little to each other. Henry had set the uncommunicative pattern of the family. The children, after romping and chattering through their early years, had, from adolescence onward, lived separate, largely undiscussed lives. Warren dropped Madeline at Radio City, not inquiring what she intended to do there. They agreed to meet for dinner, go to a show, and take a midnight train to Washington. Madeline poked here and there in the huge lobby of the RCA building, gawking at the CERT murals and ceiling paintings. She found herself at the bank of elevators for NBC entertainers and employees. Many of these people, she noticed, showed no pass to the uniformed page, but smiled, waved, or just walked busily past the roped entrance. She sailed past, too, trying to look 25 and employed. Squinting at her, the page held out an arresting hand. She dived into a crowded elevator. For an hour, she wandered the inner halls of the broadcasting company, relishing the thick maroon carpets, the immense round black pillars, the passing trucks of spotlights and broadcast equipment, the flashing red lights outside of studios, the pretty girls and handsome young men hurrying in and out of doors. She came on the employment office and hung outside, peering through the open double doors like a child at a candy counter. Then she left and spent the day shopping in department stores. As for Warren, the taxi took him a few blocks further uptown. In Rumpelmeyer's, he met a good-looking woman of 30 or so, with large, sad eyes, a cloud of ash-blonde hair, and a clever, soulful way of talking about novels, paintings, and music, subjects which did not greatly interest him. His majors had been history and the sciences. After an early lunch, he spent the day with her in a hotel bedroom. That did interest him. When he dined with his sister that evening, Madeline helped herself to a cigarette from his pack on the table, and lit and smoked it inexpertly. Her defiant, self-satisfied, somewhat pathetic air made Warren laugh. "When the cat's away, hey?" he said. "Oh, I've been smoking for years," Madeline said. The three blasts of the ship's horn, the pier girders moving outside the porthole, the band, far below, crashing out the star-spangled banner, touched a spring in Rhoda. She turned to her husband with a smile such as he had not seen on her face for weeks, threw her arms around him, and gave him an aroused kiss, opening her soft, familiar lips. "Well, we made it, Pug, didn't we? Off to Deutschland. Second honeymoon and all that, hm?" This mild pulse of sex in his hitherto preoccupied and cross wife was like a birthday present to the monogamous Pug. It augured well for the crossing, and possibly for the entire sojourn in Berlin. He pulled her close. "Well!" Rhoda broke free, with a husky laugh and shiny eyes. "Not so fast, young fellow. I want a drink. That's what I want. And I don't care if the sun isn't over the yardarm. And I know just what I want. Champagne cocktail. Or two or three." "Sure. Let's have it right here. I'll order a bottle." "Nothing doing, Pug. This will be a nice long crossing. We're getting out of here and going to the bar." The ship was clearing the dock, and hooting tugs were turning it south as the deck started to vibrate underfoot. A crowd of tired-looking, jocund voyagers already filled the bar, making a great noise. "I thought there was a war scare," Rhoda said. "Nobody here seems to be worried." They found two stools at the bar. Rhoda said, holding up her champagne cocktail.
"Well, to whom?"
"The kids," Pug said.
"Ah, yes, our abandoned nestlings. All right, to the kids."
As she polished off the champagne, Rhoda talked excitedly about the fine accommodations of the Bremen. She felt very adventurous, she said, sailing on a German ship these days.
"Pug, I wonder if there are any Nazis right here in this bar," she prattled.
The fat, red-faced man sitting next to Rhoda shifted his glance to her. He wore a feathered green hat, and he was drinking from a stein. "Let's take a walk on deck," Pug said. "See the Statue of Liberty."
"No, sir, I want another drink. I've seen the Statue of Liberty."
Pug made a slight peremptory move of a thumb, and Rhoda got off the stool. When anything touched his navy work, Pug could treat her like a deckhand. He held open a door for her, and in a whipping wind they walked to the stern, where gulls swooped and screeched, and passengers clustered at the rails, watching the Manhattan buildings drift past in brown haze. Pug said quietly, leaning on a patch of clear rail, "Look, unless we're in the open air like this, you can assume anything we say on this ship will be recorded, one way or another, at the bar, at the table, or even in our stateroom. Have you thought of that?"
"Well, sort of, but in our stateroom, too, really?"
Pug nodded. Rhoda looked thoughtful, then burst out laughing.
"You mean, you don't mean day and night, Pug, always?"
"That's what this job is. If they didn't do it, they'd be sloppy. The Germans aren't a sloppy people." Her mouth curled in female amusement.
"Well then, mister, keep your distance on this boat. That's all I can say."
"It'll be no different in Berlin."
"Won't we have our own house?"
He shrugged. "Kip says you get used to it and don't think about it. I mean, the loss of privacy. You're just a fish in a glass bowl, and that's that. You can never stop thinking about what you say or do, however."
"Honestly?"
A peculiar look, half vexed, half titillated, was on her face.
"I can't imagine why I didn't think of that."
"Well, they say love will find a way, but, oh hell, it really couldn't be less important, could it?"
"Can I have my other drink?"
An engraved card, slid under their cabin door shortly before dinner, invited them to the captain's table. They debated whether Pug should wear a uniform and decided against it. The guess turned out to be correct. A German submarine officer at the table, a man as short and as taciturn as Victor Henry, wore a brown business suit. The captain, a paunchy, stiff man in gold-buttoned blue, heavily joshed the ladies in slow English or clear German, blue eyes twinkling in his weathered fat face. Now and then he flicked a finger, and a steward in full dress jumped to his side. The captain would crackle a few words, and off the steward would bustle with a terrified face, gesturing at the waiters, long tailcoat flapping. The food was abundant and exquisite. The bowl of white and purple orchids, spectacular. The parade of wines worried Pug, for when Rhoda was excited, she could drink too much. But she ate heartily, drank normally, and delighted the captain by bantering with him in fluent German. The submarine man's wife sat on Henry's left, a blonde in green low-cut chiffon that lavishly showed big, creamy breasts. Pug surprised her into warm laughter by asking if she had ever worked in films. At his right sat a small English girl in gray tweed, the daughter of Alastair Tudsbury. Tudsbury was the only real celebrity at the table, a British broadcaster and correspondent, about 6 feet 2, with a big belly, a huge brown mustache, bulging eyes, a heavy veined nose, thick glasses, bearish eyebrows, booming voice, and an enormous appetite. He had arrived at the table laughing, and laughed at whatever was said to him, and at almost everything he said himself. He was a very ugly man, and his clothes did little to mitigate the ugliness. A rust-brown fuzzy suit, a Tattersall shirt, and a copious green bow tie. He smoked cigarettes, tiny in his sausage-fat fingers. One expected a pipe or a long black cigar, but the cigarette was always smoldering in his hand, except when he was plying a knife and fork. For all the forced badinage, it was an awkward meal. Nobody mentioned politics, war, or the Nazis. Even books and plays were risky. In long silences, the slow-rolling ship squeaked and groaned. Victor Henry and the Submariner exchanged several appraising glances, but no words. Pug tried once or twice to amuse Tudsbury's daughter at his right, eliciting only a shy smile. Over the dessert, turning away from the blonde, who kept telling him how good his stumbling German was, he made one more effort. "I suppose you're on vacation from school?"
"Well, sort of permanently. I'm 28.
"You are? Sorry. I thought you were about in my daughter's class. She's 19. The Tudsbury girl said nothing, so he kept talking. "I hope you took my stupidity as a compliment. Don't women like to be thought younger than they are?"
"Oh, many people make that mistake, Commander. It comes of my traveling with my father. His eyes aren't very good. I help him with his work."
"That must be interesting."
"Depending on the subject matter. Nowadays, it's sort of a broken record. Will the little tramp go, or won't he?"
She took a sip of wine. Commander Henry was brought up short. The little tramp was Charlie Chaplin, of course, and by ready transfer, Hitler. She was saying that Tudsbury's one topic was whether Hitler would start a war. By not dropping her voice, by using a phrase which a German ear would be unlikely to catch, by keeping her face placid, she had managed not only to touch the forbidden subject, but to express a world of contempt at the captain's table on the Bremen for the dictator of Germany. Half a dozen early morning walkers were swinging along, looking preoccupied and virtuous, when Pug Henry came out on the cool sunlit deck, after a happy night of second honeymooning. He had calculated that 5 turns would make a mile, and he meant to do 15 or 20 turns. Rounding the bow to the port side, he saw, far down the long deck, the Tudsbury girl coming toward him, pumping her arms and rolling her hips. She wore the same gray suit. "Good morning." They passed each other with nods and smiles, then, on the other side of the ship, repeated this ritual. At the third encounter, he said, reversing his direction, "Let me join you."
"Oh, thank you, yes. I feel stupid, preparing to smile 40 feet away."
"Doesn't your father like to walk before breakfast?"
"He hates all forms of exercise. He's strong as a bull, and nothing he does makes much difference. Anyway, right now, poor Talky has a touch of gout. It's his curse."
"Talky?"
Pamela Tudsbury laughed. "His middle name is Talcott. Since schoolboy days, he's been Talky to his friends. Guess why?" She was moving quite fast. In flat shoes, she was very short. She glanced up at him. "Commander, where's your wife? Also not a walker?"
"Late sleeper. Not that she'll walk to the corner drugstore if she can drive or hail a cab. Well, what does your father really think? Will the little tramp go?"
She laughed, a keen look brightening her eyes. evidently pleased that he remembered. "He's come out boldly to the effect that time will tell."
"What do you think?"
"Me? I just type what he thinks, on a special portable with oversized print."
She gestured at three deep-breathing German matrons in tailored suits marching by.
"I know that I feel queer sailing on a ship of theirs."
"Didn't your father just publish a book? I seem to remember reviews."
"Yes, just a paste-up of his broadcasts, really."
"I'd like to read it. Writers awe me. I have a tough time putting one word down after another."
"I saw a copy in the ship's library. He sent me there to check," she said, with a grin that reminded him of Madeline, catching him in self-importance or pretense. He wished Warren could meet this girl, or one like her.
Last night he had not paid her much mind, with the busty, half-naked, talkative blonde there. But now, especially with the fresh coloring of the morning sea air, he thought she had an English lady's face, a heart-shaped face from a Gainsborough or a Romney. Thin lips, expressive green-gray eyes set wide apart, fine straight nose, heavy brown hair. The skin of her hands and face was pearl-smooth. Just the girl for Warren, pretty and keen.
"You're going around again. I get off here," she said, stopping at a double door. "If you do read his book, Commander Henry, carry it under your arm. He'll fall in love with you. It'll make his trip."
"How can he care? Why, he's famous."
"He cares. God, how they care."
With a clumsy little wave, she went inside. After breakfasting alone, Pug went to the library. Nobody was there but a boyish steward. The shelves held many German volumes on the World War. Pug glanced at one titled U-Boats, 1914 to 1918, and settled into a leather armchair to scan the discussion of American destroyer tactics. Soon he heard the scratch of a pen. At a small desk, almost within his reach, the German submarine man sat with his bristly head bent, writing. Pug had not seen him come in. Grobke smiled and pointed his pen at the U-boat book.
"Recalling old times?"
"Well, I was in destroyers."
"And I was down below. Maybe this is not the first time our paths cross."
Grobke spoke English with a slight, not unpleasant, Teutonic accent. "Possibly not." When Pug put the U-boat volume on the shelf and took down the Tudsbury book, Grobke remarked,
"Perhaps we could have a drink before dinner and compare notes on the Atlantic in 1918.
"I'd enjoy that." Pug intended to read Tudsbury in a deck chair for a while and then go below to work. He had brought weighty books on German industry, politics, and history, and meant to grind through the lot on the way to his post. Intelligence manuals and handbooks were all right, but he was a digger. He liked to search out the extra detail in the extra discouraging-looking fat volume. Surprising things were recorded, but patient, alert eyes were in perpetual short supply. The bow wave was boiling away, a V of white foam on the blue, sunlit sea, and the Bremen was rolling like a battleship. Wind from the northwest, Pug estimated, glancing up at the thin smoke from the stacks and at the sea. Wind speed, 15 knots. Ship speed, 18. Number 4C on the port quarter. Rain and high winds far ahead under the cumulonimbus. Nostalgia swept over him. 4 years since he had served at sea. 11 since he had had a command. He stood by the forward rail, leaning against a lifeboat davit, sniffing the sea air. 4 unmistakable Jews walked by in jolly conversation, two middle-aged couples in fine sports clothes. They went out of sight around the deckhouse. He was still looking after them when he heard Tudsbury blare,
"Hello there, Commander. I hear you were out walking my Pam at the crack of dawn."
"Hello.
Did you see those people who just went by?"
"Yes. There's no understanding Jews. I say, is that my book? How touching. How far have you got?"
"I just drew it from the library." Tudsbury's mustache drooped sadly.
"What? You didn't buy it? Damn all libraries. Now you'll read it, and I won't gain a penny by it."
He bellowed a laugh and rested one green-stockinged leg on the rail. He was wearing a baggy pepper-and-salt golfing outfit and a green tam-o'-shanter.
"It's a bad book. Really a fake. But it's selling in your country, luckily for me. If you didn't happen to hear my driveling on the air in the past year or two, there are a couple of interesting paragraphs. Footnotes to history. My thing on Hitler's entry into Vienna is actually not too awful. Quite a time we're living in, Commander."
He talked about the German takeover of Austria, sounding much as he did on the air. Positive, informed, full of scorn for democratic politicians, and cheerfully ominous. Tudsbury's special note was that the world would very likely go up in flames, but that it might prove a good show.
"Can you picture the bizarre and horrible triumph that we let him get away with, dear fellow? I saw it all. Something straight out of Plutarch, that was. A zero of a man, with no schooling, of no known family. At 20, a dropped-out student, a drifter, and a failure. 5 years, a dirty, seedy tramp in a Vienna doss house. Did you know that, Henry? Do you know that for 5 years, this Führer was what you call a Bowery bum, sharing a vile room with other assorted flotsam, eating in soup kitchens, and not because there was a depression. Vienna was fat and prosperous then, but because he was a dreamy, lazy, incompetent misfit. That house painter story is hogwash. He sold a few hand-painted postcards, but to the age of 26 he was a sidewalk-wandering vagrant, and then, for 4 years, a soldier in the German army, a lance corporal, a messenger runner, a low job for a man of even minimum intelligence, and at 30 he was lying broke, discharged, and gassed in an army hospital. That is the background of the Führer. And then..."
The ship's horn blasted, drowning out Tudsbury's voice, which was beginning to roll in his broadcasting style. He winced, laughed, and went on.
"And then what happened? Why, then this same ugly, sickly, uncouth, prejudiced, benighted, half-mad little wretch leaped out of his hospital bed and went careering in 10 years straight to the top of a German nation thirsting for a return match. The man was a foreigner, Henry. He was an Austrian. They had to fake up a citizenship proceeding for him so he could run against Hindenburg, and I myself watched this man ride in triumph through the streets of Vienna, where he had sold postcards and gone hungry, the sole heir to the combined thrones of the Habsburgs and the Hohenzollerns."
Victor Henry smiled, and Tudsbury's impassioned, pop-eyed stare gave way to a loud guffaw.
"I suppose it is rather funny when you think about it. But this grotesque fantasy happens to be the central truth of our age."
Henry was smiling because much of this tirade was in Tudsbury's book, almost word for word. "Well, it's the old story of the stitch in time," he said. "Your politicos could have got the weird little bastard with no trouble early on, but they didn't. Now they have problems. Incidentally, where are you headed? Berlin, too?" Tudsbury nodded.
Our Berlin man's prostate chose an awkward time to act up. Dr. Goebbels said I could come along and fill in. Amazement. I've been persona non grata in the Third Reich since Munich. No doubt I'll be kicked out on my big arse in a few weeks. For some reason the Jerrys are being kind to Englishmen this month. Probably so we'll hold still while they roll over the Poles. And we will. We will. The Tories are all polite grey worms, aristocratic funks, Lloyd George called them, except for Churchill, who's quite out of it.
The American commander and the U-boat man took to meeting in the bar each evening before dinner. Henry figured that it was his job to pump Grobke, as it might well be the Germans, to work on him. Grobke was a thorough professional, an engineering expert, and a real seafarer. He talked freely about the machinery in the present U-boats, and even confessed to problems with torpedoes, a topic Henry was well-versed in, though he discussed it cautiously. In Grobke's harassed disdain for politicians, he seemed like any American naval man. A satiric look came on his face when he spoke of the Nazis, and he said things that caused his wife, when she was with them, to give him warning glances. Alastair Tudsbury said to Pug one evening, as they sat on a couch in the main saloon, watching the dancing,
"You've been fraternizing with Jerry."
"In the line of business. I doubt Grobke's a Nazi."
"Oh, those U-boat fellows are all right, as much as any Germans are."
"You don't like the Germans?"
"Well, let's talk about that after you've been there a month, assuming I haven't been booted out."
"Of course, I don't blame you. They gave your people hell."
"No worse than we gave them. We won, you know."
After a pause, he said,
"My eyes were spoiled at Amiens when we broke through with the tanks. I commanded a tank battalion and was gassed. It was worth it, all in all, to see Jerry on the run. It was a long time coming."
The captain of the Bremen, at the moment, was dancing with Rhoda. He had long, capering legs, strange in a stout man. Rhoda was radiating enjoyment. Pug was glad of this. Night after night, she had been dancing with a very tall young officer, a blonde eagle type, all clicking bows and glittering blue eyes, who held her a bit too close. Pug had said something about it, and Rhoda had countered with a brief snarl about his spending the trip with his nose in books, and he had let it drop. She was being so complacent, on the whole, that he only wanted to keep things so. The captain brought her back. Pamela Tudsbury returned from a listless effort to follow the flailing prances of an American college boy. She said,
"I shall get myself a cane and a white wig. They look so shattered if I refuse, but I really can hardly dance. And as for the Lindy Hop..."
The music struck up again, and Rhoda's tall young officer approached in spotless white and gold. An irritated look crossed Pug's face. The captain saw it, and under the loud music, as the officer drew near, he muttered half a dozen words. The young man stopped, faded back, and darted out of the saloon. Pug never saw him again. Rhoda, smiling and about to rise, was baffled by the young German's peculiar exit. "Dance, Rhoda?" Pug got to his feet.
"What?" she said crossly.
"No, thanks." Pug extended a hand to the Tudsbury girl. "Pamela?" She hesitated.
"You don't do the Lindy Hop?"
Pug burst out laughing.
"Well, one never knows with Americans."
She danced in a heavy, inexperienced way. Pug liked her gentle manner, her helpless smile when she trod on his foot.
"You can't be enjoying this," she said.
"I am. Do you think you'll be going back to the United States?"
If Father gets thrown out of Germany, which seems inevitable, I suppose we will. Why?
I have a son about your age, with quite a fine record, and, unlike me, tall and very handsome. Pamela made a face.
A Navy man? Never. A girl in every port.
At the captain's table, on the last night, there were white orchids at every lady's place, and under these, white gold compacts. Champagne went round, and the topic of international politics finally surfaced. Everybody agreed that in this day and age, war was a silly, wasteful way of settling differences, especially among advanced nations like England, France, and Germany.
"We're all of the same stock, all North Europeans," Tudsbury said. "It's a sad thing when brothers fall out."
The captain nodded happily.
"Exactly what I say. If we could only stick together, there would never be another war. The Bolsheviks would never move against so much power. And who else wants war?"
All through the saloon, people were wearing paper hats and tossing streamers, and Pug observed that the four Jews, whose table was not far away, were having as gay a time as everybody else, under the polite ministrations of smiling German waiters. The captain followed Henry's glance, and a genial superior grin relaxed his stern fat face.
"You see, Commander, they are as welcome aboard the Bremen as anybody else, and get the same service. The exaggerations on that subject are fantastic."
He turned to Tudsbury.
"Between us, aren't you journalists a wee bit responsible for making matters worse?"
"Well, Captain," Tudsbury said, "journalism always looks for a theme, you know. One of the novel things about your government to people outside Germany is its policy toward the Jews, and so it keeps turning up."
"Tudsbury is not entirely wrong, Captain," Grobka broke in, draining his wine glass. "Outsiders think of nothing but the Jews nowadays when Germany is mentioned. That policy has been mishandled. I've said so many times. That and plenty of other things." He turned to Henry.
"Still, they're so unimportant, Victor, compared to what the Führer has achieved. Germany has come back to life. That's God's truth. The people have work, they have food and houses, and they have spirit. What Hitler has done for our youth alone is just incredible."
The captain's eyes lit up, and he emphatically nodded, exclaiming,
"Ja, ja!"
"Under Weimar, they were rioting, they were becoming communists, they were going in for sex perversions and drugs. It was just horrible. Now they're working or training or serving, all of them. They're happy. My crews are happy. You can't imagine what Navy morale was like under the Republic, I tell you what."
He struck the table.
"You come visit our squadron at the sub-base in Swinemünde. You do that. You're a man that can look at the Navy yard or a ship's crew and see what's going on. It'll open your eyes. Will you?"
Henry took a moment to reply, with everybody at the table turning expectantly to him. An invitation like this, if accepted, made mandatory a similar offer to the German naval attaché in Washington. Did the Navy want to trade glimpses of submarine bases with the Nazi regime? The decision was beyond Pug's power. He had to report the invitation to Washington and act on the dictated answer. He said,
"I'd like that. Perhaps we can work it out."
"Say yes. Forget the formalities."
Grobka waved both arms in the air.
"It's a personal invitation from me to you, from one seaman to another.
The U-boat command gets damn small budgets, and we're pretty independent chaps. You can visit us with no strings. I'll see to that.
This invitation wouldn't include me, would it?
Tudsbury said. Grobka hesitated, then laughed.
Why not? Come along, Tudsbury. The more the British know about what we've got, the less likely anybody is to make a hasty mistake.
Well, here may be an important little step for peace, said the captain. Transacted at my table. I feel honored, and we will have more champagne on it at once.
And so the diners at the captain's table on the Bremen all drank to peace a few minutes before midnight as the great liner slowed, approaching the shore lights of Nazi Germany. In bright sunshine, the Bremen moved like a train between low green banks of a wide river. Pug was at the rail of the sun deck, taking his old pleasure in the sight of land after a voyage. Rhoda was below, in her usual fit of the snarls and the snaps. When they traveled together, Rhoda, in deep martyrdom, did the packing. Pug was an old hand at packing for himself, but Rhoda claimed she could never find anything he put away.
"Oh, yes, the country is charming to look at," said Tudsbury,
who had sauntered up and commenced a discourse on the scenery.
"You'll see many a pretty North German town between Bremerhaven and Berlin. The heavy, half-timbered kind of thing that looks so much like English Tudor. The fact is, Germany and England have strong resemblances and links. You know, of course, that the Kaiser was Queen Victoria's grandson, that our royal family for a long time spoke only German. And yet, on the whole, the Jerrys are stranger to us than Eskimos."
He boomed a laugh and went on, sweeping a fat hand toward the shore.
"Yes, here the Germans sit at the heart of Europe, Henry, these perplexing first cousins of ours, simmering and grumbling away, and every now and then they spill over in all directions with a hideous roar. Out they pour from these lovely little towns, these fairy tale landscapes, these clean, handsome cities. Wait till you see Cologne, Nuremberg, Munich, even Berlin and Hamburg. Out they bubble, I say, these polite, blue-eyed music lovers, ravening for blood. It gets a bit unnerving. And now here's Hitler, bringing them to a boil again. You Americans may have to lend more of a hand than you did last time. We're fairly worn out with them, you know, we and the French."
It had not escaped Henry that Tudsbury's talk, one way or another, usually came back to the theme of the United States fighting Germany.
"That might not be in the cards, Tudsbury. We've got the Japanese on our hands. They're carving up China, and they've got a first-class fighting navy growing every month. If they make the Pacific a Japanese lake and proceed to do what they want on the Asian mainland, the world will be theirs in 50 years.
Tudsbury said, sticking his tongue out of a corner of his smiling mouth,
"The Yellow Peril."
"It's a question of facts and numbers," Henry said. "How many people are there in all of Europe? A couple of 100 million? Japan is now well on the way to ruling 1 billion people. They're as industrious as the Germans, or more so. They came out of paper houses and silk kimonos in a couple of generations to defeat Russia. They're amazing. Compared to what faces us in Asia, this Hitler business strikes us as just more of the same old runty cat-and-dog fight in the backyard."
Tudsbury peered at him with a reluctant nod.
"Possibly you underestimate the Germans."
"Maybe you overestimate them. Why the devil didn't you and the French go in when they occupied the Rhineland? They broke a treaty. You could have walked in there at that point and hung Hitler, with not much more trouble than raiding a girl's dormitory.
"Ah, the wisdom of hindsight," Tudsbury said. "Don't ask me to defend our politicians. It's been a radical breakdown, a total failure of sense and nerve. I was talking and writing in 1936 the way you are now. At Munich, I was close to suicide. I covered the whole thing. Czechoslovakia, a huge chain of strong fortifications jutting deep into Germany's gut. 50 crack divisions, spoiling for a scrap. The second biggest arms factory in the world. Russia and even France, ready at last to stand up and fight. All this 6 short months ago. And an Englishman, goes crawling across Europe to Hitler and hands him Czechoslovakia." Tudsbury laughed mechanically and puffed at a cigarette made ragged by the breeze. "I don't know. Maybe democracy isn't for the industrial age. If it's to survive, I think the Americans will have to put up the show."
"Why? Why do you keep saying that? On paper, you and the French still have the Germans badly licked. Don't you realize that? Manpower, firepower, steel, oil, coal, industrial plant, any way you add it up. They've got a small temporary lead in the air, but they've also got the Soviet Union at their backs. It's not the walkover it was last year and 2 years ago, but you still figure to win."
"Alas, they've got the leadership."
A strong hand clapped Henry's shoulder, and a voice, tinged with irony, said, "Heil Hitler!" Ernst Grobke stood there in a worn, creased navy uniform. With it, he had put on a severe face and an erect posture.
"Well, gentlemen, here we are. Victor, in case I don't see you again in the confusion, where do I get in touch with you? The embassy?"
"Sure. Office of the Naval Attaché."
"Ah," said Tudsbury, "our little trip to Svinemunde. So glad you haven't forgotten."
"I'll do my best to include you," said Grobke coldly. He shook hands with both of them, bowing and clicking his heels, and he left.
"Come and say goodbye to Pamela," Tudsbury said. "She's below, packing."
"I'll do that." Pug walked down the deck with the correspondent, who limped on a cane. "I have notions of matching her up with a son of mine."
"Oh, have you?"
Tudsbury gave him a waggish glance through his thick spectacles.
"I warn you, she's a handful."
"What? Why, I've never met a gentler or pleasanter girl."
"Still waters," said Tudsbury. "I warn you."
Chapter 4 The Henrys had only just arrived in Berlin when they were invited to meet Hitler. It was a rare piece of luck, the embassy people told them. Chancellery receptions big enough to include military attachés were none too common. The Führer was staying away from Berlin in order to damp down the war talk, but a visit of the Bulgarian Prime Minister had brought him back to the capital. While Commander Henry studied the protocol of Nazi receptions in moments snatched from his piled-up office work, Rhoda flew into a 2-day frenzy over her clothing and over her hair, which, she asserted, had been ruined forever by the imbecile hairdresser of the Adlon Hotel. Pug thought the hair looked more or less the same as always. She had brought no dresses in the least suitable for a formal afternoon reception in the spring. Why hadn't somebody warned her? 3 hours before the event, Rhoda was still whirling in an embassy car from one Berlin dress shop to another. She burst into their hotel room, clad in a pink silk suit with gold buttons and a gold net blouse.
"How's this?" she barked.
"Sally Forrest says Hitler likes pink."
Perfect. Her husband thought the suit was terrible and decidedly big on Rhoda, but it was no time for truth-telling. "Gad, Where did you ever find it?
Outside the hotel, long vertical red banners of almost transparent cheesecloth, with the black swastika in a white circle at their center, were swaying all along the breezy street, alternated with gaudy Bulgarian flags.
The way to the chancellery was lined with more flags, a river of fluttering red, interspersed with dozens of Nazi standards in the style of Roman legion emblems, long poles topped by stylized gilt eagles perched on wreathed swastikas, and underneath, in place of the Roman SPQR, the letters NSDAP. "What on earth does NSDAP stand for?" Rhoda said, peering out of the window of the embassy car at the multitudinous gilded poles.
"National Socialist German Workers' Party," said Pug.
"Is that the name of the Nazis? How funny. Sounds sort of commie when you spell it all out."
Pug said, "Sure. Hitler got in on a red-hot radical program."
"Did he? I never knew that. I thought he was against all that stuff." "Well, it couldn't be more confusing. I mean, European politics. But I do think all this is terribly exciting. Makes Washington seem dull and tame, doesn't it?"
When Victor Henry first came into Hitler's new chancellery, he was incongruously reminded of Radio City Music Hall in New York. The opulent stretch of carpet, the long line of waiting people, the high ceiling, the great expanses of shiny marble, the inordinate length and height of the huge space, the gaudily uniformed men ushering the guests along, all added up to much the same theatrical, vulgar, strained effort to be grand. But this was the seat of a major government, not a movie house. It seemed peculiar. An officer in blue took his name, and the slow-moving line carried the couple toward the Führer, far down the hall. The SS guards were alike as chorus boys with their black and silver uniforms, black boots, square shoulders, blonde waved hair, white teeth, bronzed skin, and blue eyes. Some shepherded the guests with careful smiles. Others stood along the walls, blank-faced and stiff. Hitler was no taller than Henry himself, a small man with a prison haircut, leaning forward and bowing as he shook hands, his head to one side, hair falling on his forehead. This was Henry's flash impression as he caught his first full-length look at the Führer beside the burly, much-mettled Bulgarian. But in another moment it changed. Hitler had a remarkable smile. His down-curved mouth was rigid and tense, his eyes sternly self-confident. But when he smiled, this fanatic look vanished. The whole face brightened up, showing a strong hint of humor and a curious, almost boyish shyness. Sometimes he held a guest's hand and conversed. When he was particularly amused, he laughed and made an odd sudden move with his right knee. He lifted it and jerked it a little inward. His greeting to the two American couples ahead of the Henrys was casual. He did not smile, and his restless eyes wandered away from them and back again as he shook hands. A protocol officer in a sky-blue, gold-crusted foreign service uniform intoned in German, "The naval attaché to the Embassy of the United States of America, Commander Victor Henry." The hand of the Führer was dry, rough, and it seemed a bit swollen. The clasp was firm as he scanned Henry's face. Seen this close, the deep-sunk eyes were pale blue, puffy, and somewhat glassy. Hitler appeared fatigued.
His pasty face had streaks of sunburn on his forehead, nose, and cheekbones, as though he had been persuaded to leave his desk in Berchtesgaden and come outside for a few hours. To be looking into this famous face, with its hanging hair, thrusting nose, zealot's remote eyes, and small mustache, was the strangest sensation of Henry's life. Hitler said, "Willkommen in Deutschland," and dropped his hand. Surprised that Hitler should be aware of his recent arrival, Pug stammered, "Danke, Herr Reichskanzler." "Frau Henry." Rhoda, her eyes gleaming, shook hands with Adolf Hitler. He said in German, "I hope you are comfortable in Berlin." His voice was low, almost folksy. Another surprise to Henry, who had only heard him shouting hoarsely on the radio or in the newsreels. "Well, Herr Reichskanzler, to tell the truth, I've just begun looking for a house," Rhoda said breathlessly, too overcome to make a polite reply and move on.
"You will have no difficulty."
Hitler's eyes softened and warmed at her clear German speech. Evidently, he found Rhoda pretty. He kept her hand, faintly smiling. "But there are so many charming neighborhoods in Berlin that I'm bewildered. That's the real problem." This pleased or amused Hitler. He laughed, kicked his knee inward, and, turning to an aide behind him, said a few words. The aide bowed. Hitler held out his hand to the next guest. The Henrys moved on to the Bulgarian. The reception did not last long. Colonel Forrest, the military attaché, a fat army air officer from Idaho who had been in Germany for 2 years, introduced the Henrys to foreign attachés and Nazi leaders, including Goebbels and Ribbentrop, who looked just like their newsreel pictures, but oddly diminished. These two, with their perfunctory fast handshakes, made Henry feel like the small fry he was. Hitler had not done that. Pug kept trying to watch Hitler. The Führer wore black trousers, a gray double-breasted coat with an eagle emblem on one arm, and a small iron cross on his left breast. By American styles, the clothes were cut much too full. This gave the leader of Germany the appearance of wearing second-hand, ill-fitting garments. Hitler, from moment to moment, looked restless, tired, or bored. Or else he flashed into winning charm. He was seldom still. He shifted his feet, turned his head here and there, clasped his hands before him, folded them, gestured with them, spoke absently to most people and intensely to a few, and every so often did the little knee kick. Once Pug saw him eating small iced cakes from a plate, shoving them toward his mouth with snatching greedy fingers while he talked to a bemedaled visitor. Shortly thereafter, he left, and the gathering started to disperse. It was drizzling outside. The massed red flags were drooping, and from the helmets of the erect guards, water ran unheeded down their faces. The women clustered in the entrance, while Pug, Colonel Forrest, and the chargé d'affaires went out to hail the embassy cars. The chargé, a tall, mustached man with a pale, clever face full of wrinkles and a weary air, ran the embassy. After the Kristallnacht, President Roosevelt had recalled the ambassador and had not yet sent him back. Everybody in the embassy disliked this policy. It cut the Americans off from some official channels and hampered their ability to conduct business, even the business of interceding for Jews. The staff thought the president had made a political gesture toward the New York Jews that, in Germany, seemed ineffectual and laughable. The chargé said to Henry, "Well, what did you think of the Führer?"
"I was impressed. He knew I'd just arrived." Really? Well, now you've seen German thoroughness. Somebody checked and briefed him. But he remembered in that long line. The chargé smiled. Politician's memory. Colonel Forrest rubbed his broad, flat nose, smashed years ago in a plane crash, and said to the chargé, "The Führer had quite a chat with Mrs. Henry. What was it about, Pug?" "Nothing. Just a word or two about house hunting." "You have a beautiful wife," the chargé said. "Hitler likes pretty women, and that's quite a striking suit she's wearing. They say Hitler likes pink." 2 days later, Henry was working at the embassy at a morning pile of mail in an office not unlike his old cubicle in war plans. Small, crowded with steel files, and piled with technical books and reports. This one had a window, and the view of Hitler's chancellery slightly jarred him each morning when he got there. His yeoman buzzed from a tiny anteroom smelling of mimeograph ink, cigarette smoke, and overbrewed coffee, like yeoman's anterooms everywhere. "Mrs. Henry, sir." It was early for Rhoda to be up. She said, grumpily, that a man named Knödler, a renting agent for the furnished homes, had sent his card to their hotel room with a note saying he had been advised they were looking for a house. He was waiting in the lobby for an answer. "Well, what can you lose?" Henry said. "Go and look at his houses."
"It seems so odd. You don't suppose Hitler sent him?"
Pug laughed.
"Maybe his aide did."
Rhoda called back at 3:30 in the afternoon. He had just returned from lunch.
"Yes," he yawned. "What now?"
The long, heavy, wine-bibbing meal of the diplomats was still too much for him.
"There's this wonderful house in the Grunewald section, right on a lake. It even has a tennis court. The price is ridiculously cheap. It doesn't come to $100 a month. Can you come right away and look at it?"
Pug went. It was a heavily built gray stone mansion, roofed in red tile, set amid tall old trees on a smooth lawn sloping to the water's edge. The tennis court was in back, beside a formal garden with flower beds in bloom around a marble fountain swarming with large goldfish. Inside the house were oriental carpets, large gilt-framed old paintings, a walnut dining table with 16 blue silk-upholstered chairs, and a long living room cluttered with elegant French pieces. The place had 5 upstairs bedrooms and 3 marbled baths. The agent, a plump, matter-of-fact man of 30 or so, with straight brown hair and rimless glasses, might have been an American real estate broker. Indeed, he said that his brother was a realtor in Chicago, and that he had once worked in his office. Pug asked him why the price was so low. The agent cheerfully explained, in good English, that the owner, Herr Rosenthal, was a Jewish manufacturer, and that the house was vacant because of a new ruling affecting Jews. So he badly needed a tenant.
"What's this new ruling?" Henry asked.
"I'm not too clear on it. Something related to their owning real estate."
Knödler spoke in an entirely offhand tone, as though he were discussing a zoning regulation in Chicago.
"Does this man know you're offering the house to us, and at what price?" Pug said.
"Naturally."
"When can I meet him?"
"Any time you say."
Next day, Pug used his lunch hour for an appointment with the owner. After introducing them in the doorway of the house, the agent went and sat in his car. Herr Rosenthal, a gray-headed, paunchy, highly dignified individual, clad in a dark suit of excellent English cut, invited Henry inside.
"It's a beautiful house," Henry said in German.
Rosenthal glanced around with wistful affection, gestured to a chair, and sat down.
Thank you. We're fond of it and have spent a lot of time and money on it.
Mrs. Henry and I feel awkward about leasing the place.
Why?
The Jew looked surprised.
Your desirable tenants? If a lower rent would help?
Good Lord, no. It's an incredibly low rent, but will you actually receive the money?
Of course, who else? It's my house.
Rosenthal spoke firmly and proudly.
With the agent's commission deducted and certain municipal fees, I'll receive every penny.
Pug pointed a thumb at the front door. Knödler told me that some new ruling compels you to rent it.
That won't affect you as a tenant, I assure you. Are you thinking of a 2-year lease? I myself would prefer that.
But what's this ruling? Though they were alone in an unoccupied house, Rosenthal glanced over one shoulder and then the other and dropped his voice.
Well, it's an emergency decree, you understand. I am sure it will eventually be cancelled. In fact, I have been assured of that by people in high places. Meantime, this property can be placed under a trusteeship and sold at any time without my consent. However, if there's a tenant in residence with diplomatic immunity, that can't be done.
Rosenthal smiled.
Hence the modest rent, Herr Commandant. You see, I'm not hiding anything.
May I ask you a question? Why don't you sell out and leave Germany? The Jew blinked. His face remained debonair and imposing.
My family has a business here more than 100 years old. We refine sugar. My children are at the school in England, but my wife and I are comfortable enough in Berlin. We are both native Berliners.
He sighed, looked around at the snug rosewood-paneled library in which they sat, and went on.
Things are not as bad as they were in 1938. That was the worst. If there is no war, they'll improve quickly. I've been told this seriously by some high officials, old friends of mine.
Rosenthal hesitated and added,
"The Führer has done remarkable things for the country. It would be foolish to deny that. I have lived through other bad times. I was shot through a lung in Belgium in 1914. A man goes through a lot in a lifetime."
He spread his hands in a graceful, resigned gesture. Victor Henry said,
"Well, Mrs. Henry loves the house, but I don't want to take advantage of anybody's misfortune."
"You'll be doing just the opposite. You know that now. 2 years?"
"How about 1 year, with an option to renew?" At once, Rosenthal stood and held out his hand. Henry rose and shook it.
"We should have a drink on it, perhaps," said Rosenthal. "But we emptied the liquor closet when we left. Liquor doesn't last long in a vacant house."
It felt odd, the first night, sleeping in the Rosenthal's broad, soft bed with its exquisite French petit-point footboard and headboard. But within a few days, the Henrys were at home in the mansion and busy with a new life. From an employment agency suggested by the agent came a maid, a cook, and a houseman chauffeur, all first-rate servants, and, Henry assumed, all planted informers. He checked the electric wiring of the house for listening devices. The German equipment and circuits were strange to him, and he found nothing. Still, he and Rhoda walked on the lawn to discuss touchy matters. A whirling couple of weeks passed. They saw Hitler once more at an opera gala, this time at a distance, up in a crimson damask-lined box. His white tie and tails were again too big, emphasizing his Charlie Chaplin air of a dressed-up vagrant, despite his severe, stiff saluting and the cheers and applause of beautiful women and important-looking men, all stretching their necks to stare worshipfully. At two receptions arranged for the Henrys, one at the home of the Chargé and one at Colonel Forrest's house, they met many foreign diplomats and prominent German industrialists, artists, politicians, and military men. Rhoda made a quick hit. Notwithstanding her panic before the chancellery reception, she had brought a large, costly wardrobe. She sparkled in her new clothes. Her German kept improving. She liked Berlin and its people. The Germans sensed this and warmed to her, though some embassy people who detested the regime were taken aback by her cordiality to Nazis. Pug was something of a bear at these parties, standing silent unless spoken to. But Rhoda's success covered for him. Rhoda was not blind to the Nazi abuses. After her first walk in the Tiergarten, she refused to go back. It was far more clean, pretty, and charming than any American public park, she admitted, but the signs on the benches, Juden verboten, were nauseating. Seeing similar signs in restaurant windows, she would recoil and demand to go elsewhere. When Pug told her of his interview with Rosenthal, she had a deep attack of the blues. She wanted to forego the house and even talked of getting out of Germany. Why, imagine renting out that beautiful house for a song just to keep it from being sold over his head. Oh, to some fat Nazi, no doubt, lying in wait to pick it off cheap. How horrible. But she agreed that they had better take it. They had to live somewhere, and the house was divine. Day by day, she reacted less to such things, seeing how commonplace they were in Berlin, and how much taken for granted. When Sally Forrest, who loathed the Nazis, took her to lunch at a restaurant where a window placard announced that Jews were not served, it seemed silly to protest. Soon she ate in such places without a second thought. In time, the Tiergarten became her favorite place for a Sunday stroll. But she insisted that anti-Semitism was a blot on an otherwise exciting, lovely land. She would say so to prominent Nazis. Some stiffened, others tolerantly smirked. A few hinted that the problem would straighten out in time. "I'm an American to the bone, going back 6 generations," she would say. "And I'll never see eye to eye with you on this business of the Jews. It's absolutely awful." Most Germans seemed resigned to this independent, outspoken manner of American women and the way their husbands tolerated it. They regarded it as a national oddity. Victor Henry stayed off the Jewish topic. Nazi Germany was a big, not readily digestible lump of new life. Most foreigners were strongly for or against the Nazis. The correspondents, as Kip Tolliver had observed, hated them to a man. Within the embassy, views varied. According to some, Hitler was the greatest menace to America since 1776. He would stop at nothing less than world rule, and the day he was strong enough, he would attack the United States. Others saw him as a benefactor, the only bulwark in Europe against communism. The democracies had shown themselves impotent against the spread of Bolshevist parties, they said. Hitler fought totalitarian fire with hotter and stronger fire. These judgments, either way, stood on slender bases of knowledge. Pressing his new acquaintances for facts, Victor Henry got vehement opinions and gestures. Statistics abounded in sheaves of analyses and reports, but too much of this stuff also came down to guesses, propaganda, and questionable paid intelligence. He tried to study German history late at night and found it a muddy tangle going back more than 1,000 years. In it, he could find no pattern and no guide at all to the problems of 1939. Just to figure out where the Nazis had come from and what the secret was of Hitler's hold on the Germans seemed a task beyond him and beyond anybody he talked to. Even the outlandish question of German antisemitism had a dozen different explanations, depending on which of any 12 foreign servicemen you asked. Commander Henry decided that he would grope uselessly if he tried to fathom these major matters in a hurry. Military capacity was something he knew about. It was a narrow but decisive aspect of Hitler's Third Empire. Was Nazi Germany as strong as the ever-marching columns in the streets and the throngs of uniforms in cafes suggested? Was it all a show? No more substantial than the transparent red cheesecloth of the towering swastika banners. Deciding to take nothing for granted and to marshal facts for himself, Victor Henry dug into the job of penetrating this one puzzle. Meanwhile, Rhoda adapted merrily to diplomatic life. As she got used to her staff and to Berlin customs, her dinner parties increased in size. She invited the Grobkas to a big one that included the chargé d'affaires, a French film actress, the conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, and a dour, stout German general named Armin von Roon, with a peculiarly hooked nose and an exceedingly stiff carriage. Rhoda knew none of these people well. General von Roon, for instance, she had met at Colonel Forrest's house, and because someone had told her that he stood high in the Wehrmacht and was considered brilliant, she had made up to him. She had a gift for charming in a momentary encounter. She always looked elegant. She could be amusing or sexy without forcing either note, and she made one feel that it would be pleasant to know her better. People tended to accept her invitations. The company was above the level of Grobka and his wife. They were dazzled and flattered, and the presence of Roon all but froze them with awe. Grobka whispered to Victor Henry at one point that Roon was the real brain in Supreme Headquarters. So Pug tried to talk to Roon about the war and found that he spoke astonishingly good English. But he would utter only frosty generalities, which made the attaché think the better of him, though it yielded nothing to report. Before the evening was out, Grobka, full of wine and brandy, took Victor Henry aside and told him that the captain of the Swinemunde Navy Yard was making stupid difficulties, but that he was going to push the visit through.
"And I'll get your English friend in, too, goddammit. I said I would and I will. These shore-based bastards just live to create trouble."
The Henrys received one cheerless letter from Madeline, written when she arrived in Newport for the summer. Warren, as usual, did not write at all. Early in July, the letter Byron had written his father at last caught up with him. "Dear Dad, I received your letter and it threw me. I guess I gave you the wrong impression about this girl, Natalie Jastrow. It's fun to work with her, but she's older than I am, and she was a junior Phi Beta at Radcliffe. Her best boyfriend is a Rhodes Scholar. I'm not in that league. However, I appreciate your good advice. She is really excellent company, and talking to her improves my mind. That should please you. Dr. Jastrow has me researching the Emperor Constantine's military campaigns. I took the job for the money, but I'm enjoying it. That whole period, when the world balance tips from paganism to Christianity, is really worth knowing, Dad. It has some parallels to our own day. I think you'll like Dr. Jastrow's new book. He's just a scholar and wouldn't know a torpedo boat from a medium tank, yet he has a way of grasping an ancient campaign and describing it so anybody can understand it, and sort of picture what those times were like. Siena's going to be overrun with tourists for the Palio, a goofy horse race they put on every year. The nags run around the town square, and they say all hell usually breaks loose. Warren will make a great flyer. Well, I guess that's about it. Love to all. Byron. Chapter 5. Since the 14th century, so Byron had learned, nothing much had happened in Siena besides the Pollios. A rich city-state of the Middle Ages, the military rival of Florence, Siena in 1348 had been isolated by the Black Death and frozen in its present form as by a spell. A few art lovers now drifted here to admire the 14th-century paintings and architecture. The world at large flocked to Siena twice a year to watch the mad horse races, and otherwise let the bypassed town, a living scene out of an old tapestry, molder in the Tuscan sunshine. In 9 years of living just outside Siena, Aaron Jastro had never attended a Pollio. When Byron asked why, Jastro held forth on the cruel public games of Roman times, the forerunners of all these burlesque races of the Middle Ages. The Pollio had happened to survive in mountain-locked Siena, he said, like a dinosaur in the lost world. Some medieval towns raced donkeys or buffaloes, he said. In papal Rome they raced Jews. I'm not exactly afraid I'll be pressed into service if a horse should break its leg. I'm just not very interested. Moreover, his friend the Archbishop had told him long ago that elderly people avoided the Pollio because of the risk of being jostled or trampled. But now there was the article to write. Jastro obtained tickets for both runnings and sent Byron and Natalie to do research in the town while he read books on the subject. They first learned that the race was a contest among Siena's neighborhoods or parishes. Each district, called a contrada, comprised a few square blocks of old houses. All of Siena contained but 2.5 square miles and some 30,000 people, but these little wards, there were 17, and 10 competed each year, took themselves, their boundaries, their loyalties, their colors, their emblems, with inconceivable seriousness. They bore curious names like Oca, Bruco, Torre, Tartuca, Nicchio, Goose, Caterpillar, Tower, Tortoise, Seashell. Each ward had its flag, its anthems, its separate churches, and even a sort of capital hall. Byron and Natalie spent days walking through the hilly, angular streets. When an occasional old omnibus snorted by, they had to flatten against the high red-brown walls for their lives. There were no sidewalks, and the somnolent, deserted streets were hardly wider than the bus. Maps in hand, the pair visited the tiny districts one by one, trying to pin down the background of the Pollio. They found out about alliances and hatreds going back hundreds of years. Panther was friendly to giraffe, tortoise loathed snail, and so forth, in a tangle of emotions very real and current. They came to realize, too, that the famous race itself was just a crooked farce, and that everybody knew it. The Contrade owned no horses. A few days before each race, animals from the nearby countryside were brought into town, and the competing districts drew lots for them. The same stolid, durable nags came back year after year, shuffling from one neighborhood to another by the luck of the draw. What, then, made a race of it? Bribing the jockeys, doping the animals, conspiring to block the best horses or injure their riders— only such devices turned the Pollio into a murky contest of a sort. The largest, richest neighborhoods, therefore, tended to win, but the outcome was unpredictable because a poor, small district might put on a desperate surge. It might squander funds in bribes, pledge future alliances, swear to future treacheries, just to win a banner to bear off to its hall. For that was what the polio itself was, a banner painted with a picture of the Virgin. Like all medieval races, this one was run on sacred days. It was a manifestazione in honor of the Virgin. Hence her portrait graced the prize, and faded polios by the dozens hung in the Contrada halls. After a while, even Jastrow became interested too, in an ironic way. The crookedness, he said, was obviously the soul of the thing. Old European skullduggery, bribes and counter-bribes, double-cross and triple-cross, sudden reversals of old alliances, secret temporary patching up of ancient enmities, convoluted chicanery in the dark, all leading, at last, to the horse race, when all the shadowy corruption was put to explosive proof in red sunset light. "Why, this article will write itself," he said cheerfully one day at lunch. "These Sienese have evolved willy-nilly a grotesque little parody of European nationalism. The Archbishop told me that a woman from the Panther neighborhood who marries a caterpillar or a tower man will go back to have her babies in a house on a panther street to make sure they'll be panthers. Patriotism! And, of course, the insane explosion every summer is the key. All this obsolete mummery, snails, giraffes, what have you, would have died out centuries ago except for the lovely, colorful outbursts of excitement, treachery, and violence in the races. The polio is war."
"You ought to go over to town, sir," Byron said. "They're laying the track. Hundreds of truckloads of this golden red earth all around the Piazza del Campo."
"Yes," Natalie said. "The way they're decorating up the streets is quite amazing. And wherever you look, the flag wavers are practicing.
I'm taking off 2 whole work days for the races themselves. That's plenty," Jastrow said severely.
"You know what?" Byron said. "This whole thing is utterly idiotic." Natalie looked at him with startled, excited eyes, touching a handkerchief to her sweaty forehead. It was the day of the first polio, and they stood on the balcony of the Archbishop's palace, watching the parade. The great facade of the cathedral gave a bit of shade at one end of the balcony, where Jastrow, in his big yellow Panama hat and white suit, stood talking with the Archbishop. Byron and Natalie were crowded among privileged onlookers at the other end, in the hot sun. Even in her sleeveless, light pink linen dress, the girl was perspiring, and a seersucker jacket and silk tie were making Byron acutely uncomfortable. Below, the caterpillar marchers in green and yellow costumes, puffed sleeves and trunks, colored hose, feathered hats, were leaving the thronged cathedral square, waving great banners to cheers and applause from the crowd. And the red and black Owl Company was coming in, repeating the same flag stunts, intertwining whorls, 2 flags flung pole and all in the air, and crisscrossing, flag wavers leaping over each other's poles while keeping their banners in fluid motion. "Idiotic," Natalie said. "I was just deciding it's rather magical."
"What is? They do the same things over and over. We've been here for hours. There's still the porcupine, the eagle, the giraffe, and the forest to come and show off with their flags. I'm roasting."
"Ah, Byron, it's the liquid flow of color, don't you see? And the faces of these young men. So help me, these people look more natural in medieval togs than in their workaday clothes, don't they? Look at those long, straight noses, those deep-set, sad, big eyes.
Maybe they're really a remnant of the Etruscans, as they claim.
6 months of work, Byron said. Special buildings and churches for unicorns, porcupines, and giraffes. Thousands of costumes. A whole week of nothing but ceremonies, general marching hither and yon, trumpeting and drumming and trial runs, and all for one crooked race of decrepit nags. In honor of the Virgin, no less.
Oh, beautiful! Natalie exclaimed, as two owl flags flew high in the air in crossing arcs, and the wavers caught them and whirled red and black arabesques to the applause of the crowd.
Byron went on, mopping his face. I was in the Goose Church today. They brought the horse right inside, up to the very altar, to be blessed. I didn't believe the books, but I saw it happen. The priest laid a crucifix on its nose. The horse had more sense than the people. He didn't misbehave, but I guess that finished the polio for me.
Natalie glanced at him, amused. Poor Briny. Italian Christianity really troubles your soul, doesn't it? Leslie was right. You're simply a Protestant.
Does a horse belong in a church? Byron said. The sun was low when the parade ended. In the short walk from the cathedral to the Piazza del Campo, Jastrow grew nervous. A thick crowd jostled down the narrow street, all in good humor, but shouting, gesturing, and hurrying between the high red-brown stone walls of the old palazzos. More than once, the little professor stumbled and tottered. He clung to Byron's arm.
Do you mind? I've always had a slight fear of crowds. People mean no harm, but somehow they don't notice me.
They halted in a crush at a low arch and slowly squeezed through.
Good gracious, Jastrow said, as they emerged on the earth of the racetrack. The Piazza